Hello, everybody. We're just going to wait a few seconds for everybody to get connected, and then I'll start with my introduction. So just hang tight for a few seconds, hum some elevator music to yourself, and then we'll get started. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us today. For those of you who don't know, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be moderating today's Ask the Compliance Expert live stream. We're going to start a weekly series bringing a panel of leading compliance experts to you every week. We're going to be available to answer your questions about regulatory compliance, legal issue, hair care, whatever kind of questions you might have. So I hope everyone uses this opportunity to gain important insights into the issues that are or matter to you. Before I introduce our panel, let me say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the credit collection industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is completely free for everybody to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers or today's answerers. Today, first of all, we have Dennis Barton, who is the owner of the Barton Law Group in St. Louis, which specializes in collection and defense services for members of the ARM industry. His firm represents collection agencies and creditors filing collection lawsuits in the states of Missouri and Illinois. It also provides letter review services, consulting on compliance best practices, and defends agencies against consumer lawsuits nationwide. Also with us today is John Bedard, who is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. He is a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, AC International, and served as the state of Georgia compliance chairperson for AC International. Dennis and John are here today to answer your questions. So obviously, if you don't have any questions, we're just going to sit here and stare at each other for an hour. So please submit your questions and we'll get to them as our discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, you can put it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it through the chat module and we'll do our best to get to it during our conversation today. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, to make sure that neither of our great panelists get in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. So with that, John, Dennis, thank you very much for joining me on a Friday afternoon to answer compliance questions. I know everybody's moved to the edge of their seat, so appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Welcome, Dennis.
All right, so we did have a few questions that were submitted in advance, so I'm going to we'll start with those, but before you just another reminder, if you have a question for John and or Dennis, please type it in and we'll get to it during the course of our conversation today. Our first question is about a new rule that is going into effect in New York City, supposed to go into effect June the 27th. The question asks, is the rule only for New York City residents? And also, what are others putting on their letters to comply with this rule? Dennis, John, who wants to go first?
Thank you, Mike. So yes, the answer is yes, there is a new rule now in New York City that will be going into effect on June 27th. And the rules are sensitive to consumer preferences. This rule applies to all New York City licensees. And the rule really requires agencies now to learn the language preference of consumers, to document that language preference, to report on that language preference, and to provide disclosures in their letters now, which advise consumers of their ability to accommodate the language preferences of consumers. And so, yes, we will be changing our letters that go into New York City and the consumers that reside in New York City. I've got on my other screen here, I wanted to get the language right for you, Mike. And so the validation notice now must contain, quote, a statement informing the consumer of any language access services available, including whether the consumer may obtain from the debt collector a translation of any communication into a language other than English, and a statement that a translation and description of commonly used debt collection terms is available in multiple languages on the department's website. And then there's a web address. Those are the two disclosures now that are going to be required on written communication to consumers in New York City. And I wanted to read that language right out of the rule so that everybody could hear it to the extent they hadn't read the actual language of the rule. I've just recited it to everybody on the call here. And so language preference is a new sensitivity now for it's not a new sensitivity. Collectors have been sensitive to the language of consumers for years. Now that sensitivity needs to be documented, it needs to be disclosed, and it needs to be reported now in New York City, particularly with respect to this new rule.
John, I've actually already have clients, collection clients and defense clients calling me asking, you know, what they should put in. I think what you've read is great. Two things I'd like to comment on when it comes to something like this is don't be creative. Go ahead and when the statute gives you what you need to put in, just put it in. Far too often we try to add or take out language that can otherwise be pretty clear from the rule, and that can get us into trouble. And another thing I want to make sure that our listeners know is that, can I say our listeners? Does that sound too radio-y? Is that, oh, whatever. Our viewers maybe. Is that in North Carolina recently had a rule where you had to affirmatively tell people that they had, they could have deferral options. And unfortunately, a lot of people thought it meant they only had to bring it up if the consumer brought it up, but that wasn't correct. They needed to bring it up affirmatively. Now that requirement has since passed, but this is kind of the same way. You have an affirmative duty to make sure that's in your letters and not just wait until somebody asks about it.
Mike and Dennis, there's also an affirmative duty to include those very same disclosures on your website. To the extent you have a website, a consumer-facing website that they interact with, you also have to have those disclosures on the website. Now, the disclosure identifies or describes for consumers this, glossary or description of commonly used debt collection terms that the regulators in New York City are going to put on their website, which is the reason for the link over to their website. I've not checked their website yet to see if there are those terms are there yet. But to the extent the rule becomes effective on June 27th, whether they have that glossary on their website or not, our recommendation to clients is to be including that language in their letter and on their website. And to the extent, New York City doesn't have their paperwork ready or their website ready to accommodate that, that's not going to be the fault of the licensed agency that is putting those required disclosures on their website and their letters.
And one thing also, which make sure people know is, and John, you and I were talking about it before we started, is that there's a 60-day non-enforcement period. And that doesn't mean you don't have to follow the law. That means that if you don't, you're most likely not going to be, there's not going to be enforcement of it. But, you're probably, as you probably already know, waiting another 60 days past the deadline is not the way to do it. In fact, even better is to get your language in place as soon as possible. And if there is a problem and somebody brings it up, then you'll know that what you had initially was not correct and you'll have a chance to correct it, instead of throwing it out there at the last minute and then finding out you're wrong and you're past your 60-day stay of execution period.
Yeah.
Stay of enforcement, I mean.
Yep.
For those of you who haven't heard or haven't signed up already, I'm actually doing a webinar about the new New York City rule on Monday. So you can definitely sign up for that if you have a lot of questions. There are some other questions that have come in about that. One question that I think is pretty interesting is, are there any other states that have a requirement similar to New York City? Is there any harm in putting this disclosure on all G notices and our website?
Dennis, I'm not aware of another state that has these specific language preference requirements and the disclosures and the translation services, the website requirement, and the requirement to actually be able to document a language preference in a structured data format way. No, so the answer is no. I'm not aware of that. However, there are some. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but it is common, at least among the agencies that we work with, that they will record language preference anyway when they learn. I know California has some language sensitivities, and there are other states that have sensitivities about language, and being sensitive to them, I think, is right. Now, taking this language and plastering it on all of your letters and sending that all across the country, that's not something that I advocate for, because of course, I don't think we need to be sending South Dakota consumers to the New York City, DCA website to get that information. Now, to the extent you want to make available to consumers in other states certain language services, I think that's great. To the extent you want to disclose that to them, I think that's fine too. But these letter changes are not a reason to circumvent your company's ordinary letter language review process, right? Don't just slap this stuff on there and send it out the door. You have a process for changing letters, and make sure that your company follows that letter change control process, so that your letters get vetted by all the different levels of your company and perhaps even outside counsel before you put letter language changes into production.
Yeah, two things to John's point is, he talked about maybe we should just add this to everything. I so don't like that, respectfully. And the reason I don't like it isn't because it's not well-intended. It's very well-intended. But there are far too many cases out there where agencies threw everything on the letter, and then very creative plaintiff's attorneys figured out why that confused their consumers. Maybe after they got in the plaintiff's office and the attorney's office, that's when they got confused. But we don't know what the next theory is sometimes. And when you just kind of plaster stuff you don't need in a letter, sometimes we find out. That's why I always say, like, it's like selling a used car. Tell them what you need to tell them, and then stop. Don't add stuff as little as possible, and hit your legal requirements, and don't add extra stuff. Again, that's just my personal preference. To John's other question, or to the, I guess, question overall, though, I don't know of any state that has such extensive language requirements, and I can't think of actually another place that has language requirements at all offhand. But are there other states that are located close to, on the southern border, John, that have a Spanish language requirement? I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Well, the general rule is that if you begin to communicate with a consumer in another language, then, there's an expectation that you're going to provide those required disclosures and things like that. California has some specific language, preference rules. But no, New Jersey and some of those other states, I don't think they have a specific language thing like this. Whether or not this is a pretext for this kind of a requirement around the rest of the country, I don't know the answer to that. To the extent you are communicating with consumers in languages other than English, then I think there is an expectation that you're going to continue to do that, and you're going to provide consumers with the required disclosures in that other language. I agree with you, generally speaking, Dennis, about, look, just the facts, put it in there, comply with the rules and be done. But I also tell clients all the time that there is nothing wrong with providing consumers additional consumer-friendly information that you might want them to have. Although it may not be a requirement in another state to tell consumers that there are language services available to them if they don't speak English as their primary language, I don't think there's anything wrong with telling those consumers that. However, that does not mean you circumvent your company's very strict controls about how letters language gets changed and the vetting process that goes through the change control of letter language, right? Because it is possible to tell consumers consumer-friendly information, even though it might not be required by the law. I'm okay with that. What I don't like is when, because somebody thinks it's a good idea and it makes us feel good to provide additional information in a letter, it somehow circumvents the entire company's process for controlling how letters get changed. That's what I don't like to see.
And on top of that, you know, anytime a letter gets changed at all, you know, I tell all my clients, you know, have me or some, your lawyer, you know, and if you have in-house counsel or whatever, have somebody review that letter. Letter violations are easily turned into class action suits, and the little bit of money you spend to make sure a letter is compliant with the law, or, you know, to minimize your risk with that letter is well invested.
Agreed. This is probably reasonable to expect that, you know, other cities, states may follow New York City's lead and enact similar legislation down the line. It's probably might going to happen. Mike, I am curious. So how would you know, if I have a letter in English and I want to translate it to Spanish or some other language, is that something where I rely on my letter vendor to do that? Or how do you advise sort of actually going through that translation process? Because I have heard that some companies just type the text into Google Translate and copy that text, which is probably not, as John, you know, makes a really funny face, probably not the best way to do that.
Yes, I agree. That might not be the best process to have. If you're going to send letters in a different language, we're going to have the very same things in place. We're going to have policies and procedures on having that, those letter language changes. We're going to have a documented procedure on how the company gets from English to some other language. And I really like the idea of, you know, hiring, you know, an expert to translate it for you and then document the fact that it was the company's policy to follow the advice of an expert when it comes to having that translated. You know, I think that really sets up for, I mean, what else can a company do other than hire an expert to review that language and to vet those changes through their regular letter change process. I think that sets up a really nice defense to the extent a defect does happen at some point in the process. You know, that's how I would recommend they do it. I also love the idea of testing letter language through readability scores and having a company policy on the readability score of language that we use in letters that we send to consumers. You know, there even Microsoft Word has features in it that will allow us to measure the readability of the English language. And to the extent we have a policy that we will not send written communication to a consumer in writing that has a readability score that requires post-secondary education in order to read it, I think that's a fantastic policy to have. And the fact that we've documented that the, you know, the Flesch Kincaid reading score of our letters to consumers, you know, puts it at a level that we can expect the least sophisticated consumer to understand. What policy and procedure could we have that could exceed that threshold of reasonableness when it comes to, you know, drafting letter language? And then when we convert it over to a different language, you know, same thing applies. I like all of those approaches, and I think that sets up the best way to reduce risk as much as possible. And when Dennis was talking about having letters reviewed, either in house or through outside counsel, I continue to tell clients it is the best bang for your compliance buck to have your letter language reviewed, because you can use very few dollars to reduce a staggering amount of risk when it comes to having that letter language reviewed.
I agree. And one other thing real quick about, you know, you talked about some technology that can help us out with readability, and that's all great. And don't forget though, a simpler solution may be, I mean, and from a practical standpoint, you may have someone in your office that speaks that language. If you're sending out letters, enough letters, especially to someone who speaks, let's say, to consumers who are speaking Spanish only, you probably have people in your office answering calls for people who are speaking Spanish only. Don't forget to run it by them too. A collector sitting on the floor, maybe your best bet, maybe better than any technology you can think of.
Good advice. Moving on, another question that came in over the course of the week. Let's say an account is paid in full, but a request for validation is received past the validation period. Is it a best practice to still send the validation docs along with a letter stating the account is paid in full?
I will tell you that this scenario has happened with some of my clients, and it's a, you know, this is more of a business decision that I think you're legally able to do what is described, but I'm not a big fan of sending out documents when the account's closed and there's no need to. I mean, you know, there's not a right to ask for verification after the validation period, but I advise most people that if somebody asks for it verbally or in writing, just send it. That prevents them from having to go get a lawyer and cause a bunch of other trouble. But something like this, it's already closed. I don't know. I guess if they're it's interpreting the person's intent. If they just want it for their records, may fine. That's, but you don't really know what a person's intent is. And so there may be a little danger in sending that out when the account's already closed.
Are you concerned about baiting?
Yeah, I'm always concerned about baiting in every aspect of my life, sadly. That's what they've turned me into, a bait-fearing monster. No, but
Are you worried you're being baited with this question?
Exactly. This thing's, they're playing the long game, which is setting me up right now, I think. Now, you know, here at my firm, you know, people ask us for stuff, and generally we just give it because my firm doesn't get baited, fortunately. So generally that's not a concern, but for an agency, especially in an area that gets baited a lot, or, you know, where there's maybe consumers, you know, fishing around for stuff, I don't know. I think the safer bet is to send a letter that says the account is closed, and on your, make sure the letter, your full Miranda isn't on there saying that this collection, you know, it's an attempt to collect the debt. Say you're a debt collector, but leave off the rest of it. Otherwise, you've now given them, you know, some fodder for a lawsuit because you claimed you're attempting to collect the debt at the same time saying the account's closed. And I hate being like this, but this is the kind of thing that plaintiff's attorneys like to look for. John, what are your thoughts?
Well, look, I mean, I'm not aware of any law that requires a response to provide the verification that we would otherwise provide if that request came in writing and if that request came in inside the validation period, then we do have some specific obligations to stop collecting until we verify it. Remember, the FDCPA doesn't actually require debt collectors to send any verification at all. They only have to send it if they want to continue collecting. They have to stop collecting the account until they verify. It doesn't say you must verify all the time when it's requested. It just says if you want to continue collecting, you've got to verify, right? Now, I know there are some state rules, and I know there are some professional trade groups that have a different approach to that, and they want you to verify all the time. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, the law doesn't require verification all the time. And likewise, when the account is closed and returned or paid or whatever, I'm not aware of any law that requires the verification under those circumstances. And I like Dennis's approach, is to say, look, our records reflect that this account is closed. We're not working this account. Now, my next natural thought is to say, well, just refer them back to the creditor, but I know agencies don't really want to do that either. And so, you know, our records indicate that this is closed. If there's anything else we can do to help you, let us know. I'm okay with that. You know, we want to avoid angry consumers, right? You've all heard me say this 1,000 times. There are only two kind of consumers that go get lawyers and sue debt collectors. And that's bankrupt consumers and angry consumers. And so to the extent we can control angry consumers to some degree, well, let's try and avoid angry consumers by maybe not ignoring them, but being careful not to get baited like Dennis is talking about, because this has the potential to be an ill-intended behavior, right?
You know, regarding the bait, too, I want to make sure that we're clear on what we're talking about, or at least I'll tell you what I think of when I think of bait in this scenario. The account's closed and they're asking for documents. Well, what happens is you give the documents, and if they're trying to create a lawsuit and they're going to look at these documents and find anything they can that they think is a violation of law, either by you and or the creditor. So now you've gone from having no problem and money and closed account to having a problem because they've tried to turn some phrase that was in the middle of a contract into something that was or wasn't enforceable. And now everybody's everybody's violated state and federal law when you didn't have a duty to turn that over in the first place. And in a more practical standpoint, I think is, as a collection attorney, when I get an account, I get all the documents because I have to do a meaningful attorney review, right? So I don't get an account and then call creditor or call an agency that placed it or a creditor or whatever for more information, because it's usually right there with me unless I have questions. That's not true for an agency. You know, usually you don't have all the contracts and, you know, ledgers and invoices and all that because you don't need them, right? Under the law, you don't need that. So now this person's closed account and now they want this stuff. So do you really want to have to go through the hassle of contacting your creditor and asking for information? The creditor's going to be like, well, I thought this was closed, and you're going to have to explain it's not. And then you're going to explain why you're going to give it. It turns into a eating away, if nothing else, eating away a bunch of time. And you don't really have time because that's a very precious resource in our industry. So I'm going to amend my answer from to, yeah, don't do it. That's my answer. Final answer.
So just to make sure, so to not give you any more opportunity to amend your answer, let's move on. Another question that has come in. How should we handle frivolous disputes that we have previously provided validation on? I see Dennis laughing.
Well, you know, frivolous disputes, you know, you hear about it all the time. And I guess it really depends on, you know, why you think it's frivolous. Is it something where you believe it really is from the consumer, but it's just baseless, or it's a repeat? You know, so depending on what the question is really intending. But if they're asking about a robo dispute, there's a lot of agencies not responding at all and just throwing them away. In fact, I just talked to one agency owner yesterday that talked about they're getting all these robo disputes in the mail and these letters in the mail, and they're throwing them away based on the postage because it's bulk rate instead of first class rate, and that's great. That's smart. There's always a danger, of course, when you get a dispute and a direct dispute, I guess I'm talking about. And you think it's from a credit repair organization or frivolous for some other reason, or, you know, invalid for some other reason, there's always a risk, because if it isn't invalid and you needed to respond to it and you don't, now you've kind of, well, not kind of, you've now, you know, violated your requirements under the FCRA. So part of this is business and some of it's a legal strategy, but if you think it's a legitimate dispute, but just a legitimate meaning it's really from the consumer, but it's frivolous. If it's if it's direct, you know, you're able to say that, but you still have to respond. If it's through the credit reporting agency, though, you don't have an ability to call it frivolous. You have to respond normally, and therein, you know, you get them over and over. Therein starts to create a business risk of not responding, because, you know, the FCRA doesn't allow for us to call disputes frivolous when they are placed through the bureau. John, what are your thoughts?
There's a lot about this question that we don't have the background on, which is very important, which is, do you mean under the FDCPA? Do you mean under the FCRA? There are different rules that apply to each of those. And so, I have a lot of clients who think most of the disputes they receive are frivolous. And so I like the idea of a company having a policy and a procedure, one, that defines frivolous dispute, and two, has a procedure for handling frivolous disputes, because it's easy to characterize a dispute as frivolous without having actually a company policy or a procedure to actually say, we follow this policy, we've defined it, we know what it is. And so, to the extent a debt collector believes that a dispute they received was frivolous, but they received it in writing and they received it inside the validation period, well, then there's some really specific rules you got to follow under the FDCPA. If you receive a dispute in the mail in writing from a consumer that they're complaining about something that is contained on their credit report, well, that's a direct dispute under the FCRA. And the FCRA has some very specific procedures that you have to follow if you want to characterize that dispute as frivolous. And that procedure includes notifying the consumer that you've determined that their dispute is frivolous. And there's a bunch of reasons that the FCRA identifies as qualifying as a frivolous dispute. As Dennis said, if that dispute comes in through eOscar, game over. The law does not give a furnisher the discretion to characterize an eOscar dispute as frivolous, and that dispute must be investigated using reasonable procedures to investigate. So there's a lot of different there are a lot of different branches to that dispute question, depending on the nature of the dispute, the sequence of that dispute in the collection process, the how the dispute comes in, all of those kind of things. That's a very long answer to what really began as a very short question.
No, I think this question, you could do an entire session on, maybe a whole week's worth, because all these words have all, frivolous. What do you mean by frivolous? You know, there's legal definitions, but sometimes, we get a little more lackadaisical with how we view things, and we just call it, this is frivolous. And, maybe that doesn't fit the legal definition. I'll tell you some cases that I'm seeing come up a lot, that I'm defending a few of these myself, in fact, is that there are calls and the person is calling after the validation period and they dispute the debt. And so then the collector does a reasonable thing and say, okay, what's the basis for your dispute? So I think you are allowed to ask for more detail about the dispute. Are we talking about the creditor? Are you talking about the amount? Because if you don't know the basis of the dispute or more details about the dispute, how are you supposed to, really respond? You want to do your full investigation, whether you're credit reporting or not, in fact. So you're allowed to ask that. But what's happening in these cases is that, collectors are saying, okay, well, you dispute, but you're past the validation period, so it's invalid, it's frivolous, and they don't, they don't do anything. Right. Or they still record it as disputed for purposes of credit reporting, but on that phone call, they call it invalid or frivolous, or they say some other language that leads to that sort of conclusion. And then the FDCPA case pops up saying, people are allowed to dispute whatever they want, and you can't call it invalid, and you got to write it down and all this stuff. So be careful with how you view or how you use the term frivolous, and whether you mean it legally speaking as it's defined under the FCRA, or if you just mean kind of, you think it's BS and you don't want to deal with it. So, because those are maybe two different ways to handle those maybe.
Context matters.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Another question. Are any functions of third-party debt collections prohibited from being performed offshore by any U.S. laws or statutes? Do any states prohibit the issuance of an offshore license to perform debt collections?
My very clear, concise answer is I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know.
I don't know if any states actually prohibit outright offshoring. I don't really know the answer to that either, Mike. I don't think that states that require branch licensing and things like that, I don't think you can circumvent those rules just because you're using an outsourced location that's offshore. But whether or not there are states that specifically prohibit it, my gut is telling me that there are some, but I can't name them, and I hesitate to even say that because I don't know.
Okay.
When do lawyers ever say they don't know, right? Isn't the cardinal rule, if you don't know, make it up? But we don't do that, do we, Dennis?
Absolutely not.
Only the good lawyers say, I don't know.
I was just going to say the good lawyers make up the answer. No.
Yeah. Only the good lawyers.
By the way, we just got a comment in the chat box here that regarding our last question, that somebody asking for the documents and specifically saying I need this to see if it meets the requirements of an FDCPA violation. So that's a good deal.
At least they're being honest.
Baiting, huh?
All right, another one. Let's see here. I have two questions. Number one, is there a difference between verification of debt and validation of debt, or is it the same?
So the statute uses the word verification. You must send verification, right? You know, it's jargon, industry jargon is to use the word validation when the statute uses the word verification. And so I think that people in the industry use those words synonymously. Dennis, do you have any other, I mean, is that your experience?
Yes, it's my experience. Here's my opinion. And I've come to this after doing this for a while, because I had the same question for a long time. And when I finally came to the conclusion that really you validate a debt as a verb, you validate it through verification, a noun. So one's a verb, one's a noun. But really,
it was somebody says you can verify a debt through through validation.
I don't appreciate your question. yes, of course, whatever. Who knows?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought. Please go ahead.
No, I'm done. It's really validation. Send me validation, send me verification. It's the same. It's the same thing.
Okay. The second question is, using the word today considered overshadowing the validation period when the consumer is in the validation period, and is that a violation?
If it says pay today, it certainly is.
Yeah.
It's due today. Pay us today. Where are you today? Or whatever. Yeah. Today's bad. Take that out.
I like to tell clients to avoid words of timing in there, you know, now, today, soon, hurry, you know, things like that. At least in the initial communication, in the validation notice, here we are using the word validation. In the validation notice, I tend to encourage clients to avoid timing, urgency, words that communicate urgency.
I agree. One thing I don't like too that I've seen before is that an agency will try to get away around that by saying, you know, respond within 45 days. Or if you don't respond in 45 days, we'll do this other thing. I don't like any of it. It still adds a sense of urgency. The counter argument, of course, is that, well, by 45 days, the validation period is long gone. And so what's the problem? You know, what could happen is the person didn't receive it. Maybe they're on vacation. Maybe this new mail is slow. I mean, for whatever reason, they don't receive it. And so by the time it comes, your 45-day clock is different than their 45-day clock. And now you're starting to do things. And I don't know. I just don't like numbers like that.
Good answer. Another question. Are there any states that prevent serving a borrower with a summons and complaint or the action to obtain a judgment yet due to COVID-19 restrictions?
Well, there are some that have tried. and you know, some have been stricken but you know, I'm not aware of a state that has prohibited the filing of a collection action to the extent the court was open and operating and all that. There are lots of courts that just shut down, right? There are, however, for example, in Georgia here for a long time, you could not file a garnishment, which isn't necessarily a collection action, which I think, however, also implicates First Amendment issues. But to the extent any state outright prohibits the filing of a collection action, I don't think that can withstand constitutional scrutiny. I don't think it can. They might try, and unless they're challenged, they will get away with it. But, I feel strongly that it is all of our responsibility to prevent and to stop government's sort of overreach when it comes to making rules like that, even in the face of benevolent intent to help people. We don't just throw away our principles because of exigent circumstances. And to the extent our system of government is founded on principles of the right to petition and speech and all those other things, we just can't push them aside just because we've got some emergency circumstances right now. In fact, I advocate that it is even more important to adhere to those principles under times of duress and stress and emergency and you know, pandemic.
I'm hearing the Star Spangled Banner behind you while you're saying that. I'm hearing that music, baby. You need that. You need a soundtrack, Mike. You just put that in next time he goes on one of those.
I will absolutely get the music queued up.
I'll step off of my soapbox.
No. I'd say Illinois is violating our First Amendment rights, as John would put it.
Yes. So is Nevada, and so is D.C., and so was Massachusetts, and the fact that they are getting away with it is awful.
Sure, but we're in a. You know, but I do want to tell you though, there's also what's happening. There's the law and there's rules and regulations, and there's also what's happening on the ground sometimes. And in Illinois, where you could file stuff and collection actions, and there was no violation to do so, and everything should have been honky dory. Sheriffs weren't serving them.
Right.
Unilaterally deciding not to. Courts were sometimes unilaterally deciding not to enter them. Missouri, thankfully, I always think I just totally lucked out by starting a collection practice in Missouri because it is so great here. I mean, we have almost no regulation statewide. You know, the courts were fine during the COVID crisis. They let you file, we serve. I mean, it's great. Illinois, totally different experience. But, you know, there though, that's where it comes in. And sometimes there's local ordinances too. There was a county in Missouri that had a hold on garnishments, even though the state didn't, and had a hold on serving lawsuits, even though the court was allowing them to be filed. So sometimes it's a very very local issue.
Yeah, and to me, that is form over substance. To the extent you're violating the Constitution by preventing the filing of something, it is no different than allowing the filing but preventing its effect by not allowing service and all those other things. And so, it's an attempt at clever circumvention of what is otherwise very clear violations of the law.
Sure. John, someone wants to know the name of your pet bald eagle.
my pet bald eagle. We call him BLG. BLG, yeah.
Excellent. I mentioned Monday's webinar on the New York City debt collection rule. Tuesday's webinar is actually on the FDCPA and whether or not it is constitutional or unconstitutional under the First Amendment.
I love it.
I have. We actually have a couple of attorneys, including a plaintiff's attorney, who are going to come debate the constitutionality of the FDCPA under the First Amendment.
Yep.
So that should be an interesting conversation.
That's going to be great. That's going to be great.
Another question. If you receive a bankruptcy notice of filing, but you no longer have a contract with the client, is the agency obligated to notify the client or the court?
From a business standpoint, I would. I don't think you have an obligation, but I think you should. You should. I mean, just being a good partner, business partner, I don't know if there's an obligation to.
Well, we are not at the question omits specifically the source of the obligation. Is there a legal obligation? I'm not aware of a legal obligation that requires the communication of that information back to the client. To the extent you have a contractual obligation to do that, because those terms survive, you know, the termination of your collection agreement with them, well, then maybe you do have an obligation. But in the absence of those two things, I'm not. You know, I can't think of a reason that somebody would be obligated to do it, which is a different question than whether or not it's good business practice, like the gentleman from Barton Law Group just identified.
Well said. Just a reminder, we've only got a few minutes left. If you have a question for John or Dennis, please enter it into the chat box or the Q&A box, and we will get it asked before we wrap up here today. Looking through the questions that have come in, let's see if there's anything we haven't tackled yet.
I think I did see one question about what if the language that is being taught, like Creole, and how do you pronounce that?
Creole.
And Louisiana, I think. So, you know, what happens when it's not a recognized academic, you know, recognized by academia, or there's no industry standard for that language? And so I would say that you wouldn't have an obligation to then send anything in that in a language that is not an official language. But I've never tackled that issue. John, have you tackled that issue?
I've not either. And I don't even know what an official language is. Is there some book that says these are the only official languages in the world? I mean, no. And so, that's a good question that I don't have an answer to either. I wouldn't even attempt to try and translate something into Creole. I don't know if that's a dialect of English or whether or not it's actually a language. That shows you how ignorant I am about language. Just to be perfectly clear about how ignorant I am about the Creole language, I've demonstrated that just now.
But you know about other languages, right? Like English, you're solid on that one.
You know, some people beg to differ whether I even know anything about English. But for most other languages, the answer is no.
Got it. Hope that helps answer the question. Let's see here. Is there anything else we haven't tackled, gentlemen?
No, other than to stay tuned. The Supreme Court should be coming out with some decisions here pretty soon.
We're anxiously awaiting what CELA law and AAPC for VBAR, the TCPA ruling.
I don't know if the TCPA one will be this term. I don't know if it's this term or next term for that one, but CELA law we should be seeing soon, right? I mean, I'm kind of excited to see what happens with that case.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people were expecting it as early as this week
because
the arguments were heard so long ago. So
correct.
The next set of rulings comes out Monday, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
I think so. I think they're releasing every Monday. So
stay tuned.
We can definitely stay tuned for that. Since you raised the question, any predictions on what you think the Supreme Court is going to do?
Well, if they do the right thing, they will strike down Dodd-Frank. But that's a very unpalatable thing to do, right? That is very unpalatable. Here's my prediction. My prediction is that CELA law will win the ultimate case. The petition to enforce the CID will be denied, right? Because that's all that this case is about. The Bureau is trying to enforce a subpoena. And so my hope is that the petition to enforce the petition will be denied, and it will be denied because of a constitutional defect in Dodd-Frank. But I don't necessarily think the Supreme Court really has an obligation to explain further. If they reach the conclusion that there's a constitutional defect in Dodd-Frank, I think that alone is enough to justify denying the petition. And that can be the end of the opinion right there. We don't have to go further. We don't have to say, do we have to remove the offensive language? Do we have to do all that? I mean, maybe they don't have to go there. I would like to see that happen.
Such an outcome is the most problem. I'm sorry, John, did you have something else you were saying?
Well, I just wanted to say, removing the offensive language from Dodd-Frank would be almost the worst thing the Supreme Court could do, in my view. That would be awful. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows?
Generally, the Supreme Court takes the they take the road of least resistance, meaning if they can decide a case on a very narrow, have a very narrow result and to resolve the case, they will, which is why if they can decide this without deciding a major, you know, dissolving a federal agency or or creating a line, what would really be a line item veto empowered by the Supreme Court, which would be would be a constitutional crisis. Yeah. They're not going to do that. They're going to take the easy way out, make it a very case specific result, and anyone who really wants to draw a lot from it will be disappointed. That's my prediction, and I hope I'm wrong and it goes our way. But
cue the Star-Spangled Banner, bald eagles. You ready? I think the Supreme Court needs to send a message to Congress that when Congress pushes the envelope and goes too far, The Supreme Court is not going to bail them out by finding, by deciding cases in a way that is least destructive to the most people, right? Because it would be awfully destructive if they just struck Dodd-Frank and in one decision, all of the CFPB is gone, right? That would be extremely destructive. But I think it is a worse gamble not to tell Congress that when they push the envelope and they create legal juggernauts that are unconstitutional, well, then they are going to suffer the consequence when that juggernaut hits the ground because it's unconstitutional. And it would be awful if the only thing causing the Supreme Court to resist the only right thing to do, which is to find them unconstitutional, if they resisted striking everything down because the consequences would be so great, that emboldens lawmakers to constantly push the envelope because they know the Supreme Court isn't gonna upset the apple cart too much. That would be terrible. Okay, I've stepped off now.
Well, and here's the good news about all this. You know, we've just said some what we think is probably gonna happen. That's kind of, you know, not really all that. It's not gonna be very influential moving forward. But who knows? Nobody expected the recent rulings on transgender rights and DACA to go the way it did. So who knows?
Yeah, stay tuned. That'll be a good seminar, Mike.
Absolutely. I can't wait for that one. To the person who asked the bankruptcy question, I think this is one we just answered. If the account has been closed and returned to the client in a notice of chapter, whatever is received, is the agency required to forward this notice to the client? We did address that, so I guess people can just, you can review the recording for a more detailed answer. But if I summarize correctly, there's no legal obligation, but more sort of a business relationship obligation to notify the client. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Well, we said that, it could be contract. John, I should say, mentioned it might be part of your contract, and especially right. If it's just a onesie twosie here and there, you should probably do it just out of goodwill.
Got it. All right. Well, I don't see any other questions in the queue, so I think we can wrap this up, guys. Thank you so much, John. Thank you so much, Dennis. Really appreciate your continued participation, your continued willingness to help and provide guidance to people who are in search of it. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, guys. A lot of fun to be here.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. If you're a listener. Really appreciate your time. Hope everyone has a great weekend. To all the fathers out there, happy Father's Day. And we'll be back next week with, I think I've got 5 webinars next week. So be seeing a lot of you next week. Everybody take care.
Bye-bye. Happy Father's Day out there.